I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star.
Hello, Michael.
Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
Misty Oaks with us is a magna cum laude graduate of North Carolina Central University School of Law. She operates her own practice, her own law practice, the Oaks Firm in Atlanta, where she's most passionate about loan modification and foreclosure defense. She was featured in the Atlanta area magazine, People You Need to Know. Part of her job as an attorney, entrepreneur, speaker, and radio personality, the Misty Oaks Experience, is to break down the law to the general public in a way that's both accurate and entertaining. An expert in civil, criminal, and real estate law, Misty is available, and here she is right now. Misty, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. Misty, when it comes right down to it, most people have no idea what the dynamic of a jury is. We take a look at it and we say, well, you know, there's 12 people of your peers and they were chosen and they have to be on jury duty and they're going to decide, quote unquote, life or death, good or bad, about someone who has been accused of something. Now, the one thing I want to touch on before we go farther, years ago, I remember there was something that was addressed on the show was jury nullification. The power is in the jury. Is that so today?
The power is in the jury. Well, I think that is mostly true. However, with the media and people being tried in the media prior to even getting before the jury, I think that the people generally have a trial a lot of times before the trial in the courtroom. And also, too, another aspect of that is that the jury certainly has power. I mean, that is the essence of the American justice system. But a side note to that is that a jury's decision can always be overruled by a judge. And so that's an important point to keep in mind. So yes, juries have power. They always have. They always will, as long as this is an American democracy. But they are, human beings that are often influenced by the things that they see and read and hear and the people that they talk to, that listen to the media, before they even get into the jury room. So that's also an important consideration.
You look at high drama, high maintenance, and some of these trials, Misty, they're almost like watching a movie. And I guess the most famous one right now has got to be Casey Anthony. To this day, I have no idea how she walked away scot-free, and she probably will. But when it really comes down to it, it has to be that decision without a reasonable doubt. And they had reasonable doubt. There was a month that went by or so where her child was missing, the kids out partying and so on and so forth. And yet at the same time, they said she didn't do it. How did they come to a conclusion like that?
Oh, man, I got to tell you, that is, I think, going to be the question for a lot of law school classes all over the United States. It's really two parts. First of all, the prosecution has to prove each and every single element of a charge beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's not just murder generally. It's malice aforethought. It's intent. It's substantial steps. So it's every single element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And really, they didn't have it, in my personal opinion. I thought this all throughout the trial. They do not have enough for murder. When you don't even have a cause of death, you know, they couldn't even prove what the cause of death was, so how can you prove that somebody intentionally murdered someone? So that was a very difficult thing. And so one other point that I want to make on that topic is that the prosecution could have charged Casey Anthony with a lot of other charges that they possibly could have won on, but they decided to charge her with murder and aggravated child abuse and certain things that they charged her with. For whatever reason, I will never know. But the jury can only convict on the charges that a criminal defendant is charged with. So they may have found that there wasn't enough to convict her of intentional planned out murder or intentional aggravated child abuse, but there could have been some other crimes that there was enough evidence to prove that they just simply could not convict her on because those charges were not presented to them.
But what about unintentional, quote unquote, if there's such a word, child neglect? I mean, literally, the kid's right. gone for a month and you don't even report it. Is there something within the law?
Right.
Yeah. What do you do with something like that? So what I'm hearing you say, and please stop me if I'm wrong because I'm not an attorney, but what we're saying is there could be six charges that could possibly go against this young woman. But maybe there's only three that we can really charge her with, so we have to go with the three that we think will stick, and even if the other ones would, they're going to drift away. So there's only a certain amount of things you can charge with at that particular trial then.
Well, no. Okay, let me answer the first part of that question because you absolutely hit the nail on the head. I actually just recently got done writing an article about that same exact issue. They could have charged Casey Anthony with child neglect. They could have charged her with child endangerment. You know, if her neglect lasted so long and was so pervasive that the child was murdered or died, you know, while the mother was unaware or didn't report anything for 30 days, that's neglect. You know, if your child is missing for 30 days and you don't say anything, that's neglect, no question about it, you know. So they certainly could have charged her with child neglect, child endangerment, even potentially negligent homicide, you know, where the parent is so negligent that a homicide occurred during the parent's negligence. That could have been a potential charge. Now, in answer to your second question, prosecutors can charge really, and I don't want to say anything they want to with no limits, but they have wide discretion to choose whatever charges or whatever amount of charges, whatever number of charges they would like. And so it's not that they were limited to three charges or six charges or whatever they charged her with. It's that they decided, and really it's a matter of strategy. I don't think their strategy was a very good one, but it's a matter of strategy that they decided they're not going to confuse the jury. You know, if you're charging a defendant with some heavy-hitting felony, murder, you know, aggravated child abuse, serious charges, a lot of times you don't want to add in lesser charges because you don't want to confuse the jury, you know, because a lot of times juries feel like, well, how can we charge her with murder, which is one of the most heinous crimes, and then charge her with a really, like, lesser charge, lesser punishment crime like negligence. You know, the two don't go together, so it makes it difficult for them to decide, you know. So I think it was just a matter of strategy for the prosecution to say, let's just charge her with these, you know, four or five crimes and stick to these, you know, as opposed to including everything.
Okay, Misty, let me ask you this. Now, as an attorney, obviously you're skilled, you're trained, you've been there, you've done that. If we look deep into this thing through your eyes now, what do you find?
What do I find, you said?
Find, yeah. The system.
What do I find? Well, that's an interesting question. I'm working on something called Fair System but Absurd Results. And it's really kind of like a column or an article piece that talks about how I believe the American justice system is fundamentally fair. No question about it. You can look at the justice system in any other country around the world, and the United States American justice system is one of the most fundamentally fair, balanced, and sound anywhere. No question. Sure. But the people working within the system are not necessarily so, and certainly not all the time. And so, therefore, we have been producing a lot of absurd results, in especially lately. I find that we as people are, of course, faulty and opinionated and sometimes discriminatory.
Sure.
And so you have cases like Warren Jeffs, the Texas polygamist leader, who got sentenced to like 100 years in prison for, you know, child abuse or child rape. And I'm not saying that's not a heinous crime. It certainly is. But there are other people that get 7 years for something like that, or maybe 14 years for something like that. But he got 100 years. Now, why is that? You know, because he's a religious leader with a lot of power, a lot of influence, and maybe, you know, the powers that be or the people working within that system didn't like that amount of power and influence. I don't know. You know, and so in any event, and there are many, many cases across the board, you know, many, many, many. Casey Anthony, you know, this case sends a message two people, you know. And so I find that we have a fair system, but a lot of times we don't have very sound or fair results.
Let me jump in just a minute, because what this brings it down to is back to, are we a nation of a rule of law or the rule of man, quote unquote? And I think, for instance, based on geographical location, based on the kind of population, I mean, he could have been tried anywhere else, and they may have come up with something completely different. And there's no commonality of justice across this country right now. And I think there in and itself, you know, lies the problem. You look at these different people, O.J. Simpson, whatever it was, the man walked, you know, and it's the same thing with the Anthony case. If you took a look at it and you realistically saw what happened, the guy did it. But he walked, for whatever reason why he walked. And I really believe it has to do with the popular opinion of the time of whatever the population is, the geographic location, the culture of the state that they're in. And each state in and of itself has its own culture, which is a derivative of a society. And I think all of those variables go into play when you're dealing with, is somebody going to be guilty or not?
That's absolutely correct. And I think you just proved the answer to that question, that this is a society of the law of man, quote unquote, I think, really. And in large part, laws are shaped by society. You know, they are constantly evolving. They are living things. They can be amended, changed. We enact new legislation all the time just to keep up with the changing times and the changing mindset and the changing culture in the world that we live in. So certainly law, you know, is fundamentally supposed to be about
like
fairness.
Supposed to be is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be is good.
Right.
Yeah.
I
love the way you said it. And it makes so, it does. It's spot on. It hits it. Law is supposed to be. The rule is supposed
right.
to be. This is how it should be. It's not always that way.
Right. It's not always that way. Unfortunately so, but I mean, that's, you know, we're dealing with faulty people. You know, people that are fundamentally limited and flawed simply because we are human beings. And so, you know, we try, and I think in this country more so, like I said, than any other country, we get very close, very, very close to maintaining balance and justice and fairness. But then you have the unfortunate cases that send really, really not good messages, like Casey Anthony or O.J. Simpson or Warren Jeffs. So.
And by the way, what it boils down to is this.
What
we have created, and I have to say we have created, you and I and everybody here, we're all the same. We've created a society. We're dealing with a society, for the most part, that's not listened to, not cared about, not encouraged. And for the most part, until we need something, you know, and someone needs something of us, let me say it that way, we're forgotten. And we're people who live, we have a freedom of religion, of choice, of opinion, sexual orientation, and on, but you could be sued if you exercise any of them. So isn't that a little bit of contradiction in terms?
I don't know if it's so much a contradiction, so much as it is two sides of the same coin. When you have freedom, you can't really limit. I mean, well, you can. We have to a certain extent. But you have freedom all across the board. I mean, the same way that I'm free to say whatever I want to say or practice whatever religion I want to practice, somebody else is free to call me on that or to file a lawsuit against me on that. I mean, it's really two sides of the same coin to a large extent. In this country, we don't typically really restrict who can sue. I mean, we do have some laws about frivolous lawsuits and, you know, certain things and dollar amounts for different jurisdictions and all that kind of stuff. But really, I could sue somebody for saying anything, you know, that I didn't necessarily like. Would it win? Would it be, you know, meritorious? I don't know. That's a whole other question, you know. But we're free, and thank God for it, you know. But I think that, you know, when you say one group of people is free or a large group of people are free, You kind of have to let that just, you have to let them run with it to a certain extent. You know, you can't say you're free to practice whatever religion and then tell somebody they can't sue you for practicing it on their property or something, you know? And then to answer the first part of your statement, I completely agree with you. Completely agree. You know, the Constitution says that the powers that are not reserved or delegated to the federal government are, you know, reserved for the states or the people. And so that means that the people are supposed to be powerful. The people are supposed to be, have a voice and be thought about and be important and be heard. But a lot of times, you know, the larger government or the quote unquote powers that be don't really focus on us or want to hear from us until it's tax time, you know, until it's time to pay those income taxes. We're not really thought about.
Misty, I hate to do this. We're running out of time now. And I'll tell you what. I like you and I like the way you present yourself. And if somebody wants to sue me for it, go ahead.
I'll protect you.
Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. My law firm's website is The Oaks Firm, and that's OAKS, like the tree, theoaksfirm.com. And also you can find us on Facebook and or Twitter at The Oaks Firm, and that's OAKS, like the tree. So check us out. We do all sorts of stuff here. So we should certainly be able to help you. And if we can't help you, we can point you in the right direction.
Wonderful. Hey, Misty Oaks, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good night.
Okay, have a good one. Bye-bye.
Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London.
Hey, Seth, is our guest up?
I'm right here.
Oh, good. Thank you. And I'll introduce you. You know, that I didn't hear that you were here. And if you give me a second, we'll give you an intro that you'll never forget, okay?
Oh, gosh. Okay,
hold on. Camarado with us. She is an award-winning author of the books Skinny, Tan, and Rich, Unveiling the Myth, and Hindsight, What You Need to Know Before You Drop Your Drawers. She's a national speaker, a clinical hypnotherapist, and a relationship coach, and a radio personality. And let us say, Marianne, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being a certificate of responsible relationship. Does that mean if I meet somebody and I like them and they like me, I have to get a certificate before I can go further?
Actually, the hope is that you've done some work before you even get to that point. That's why we created the program. We've seen so much heartache over the last, I guess, 30 years collectively, the folks and I put this program together, that we wanted to see if we could somehow circumvent that from happening, right? So you get 6 tools in your relationship tool belt, and you approach relationship responsibly versus in hindsight, right? We want to stop at some point saying, hey, I wish I would have known then what I know now.
And now, by the way, I completely and totally, Marianne, agree to that. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have to date is that there are so many people who get into a relationship and that first year divorce rate is like 55 plus percent. Second is even worse than that. And I think when it really comes down to it, they don't know how to be in a relationship. This is not something that you fall into. Relationship has got to be a learned strategy, and I think it should start in junior high school.
Absolutely, and well before that. We are so, and forgive me for using the word propagandize, it's just really an institution, the idea that chemistry is a great litmus test for relationship and that happily ever after is a place that really exists. And so many of us really don't inquire beyond these notions, right? We just get programmed or indoctrinated, like I said, when we're kids.
Sure.
And unlike almost every other area in life that we want to be successful in, we don't educate ourselves, like you said. So that's why we came up with a program that speaks specifically to that. If you want a healthy, fulfilling, sustainable relationship, you need to do some homework. Otherwise, you get what you get. You get a bunch of chemistry that fades after a while. Your patterns and subconscious beliefs and love map and all that stuff that most of us don't know one whip about emerges, and we have these battles of our unconsciousness that is now conscious, and ultimately 80% of the time now destroys the relationship before we even know what hit us.
Yeah, I know there's an area that you address that why men lie. I know why we lie.
Because
no,
you can.
I do.
No, why do you think you lie? You're the guy. You tell me why.
This is why we lie. I meet you, and don't tell your husband. I meet you, and I really like you, right? I want to let you know what I think you think I should be like. And I'm not going to tell you who I am. And then
exactly.
We meet and we get into a relationship and it starts to move along. And then all of a sudden I start acting like who I am. And a year later you look at me and you say, I'm out of here. Why?
Yeah.
You're not
what
who
happened
I'm
to
that.
The other guy who used to open my door and be nice to me and listen to me go on and on and act like he cared? Where did that guy go? And let's take the other side of that case. Not just why men lie, why we lie, because we think inherently who we really are, like you said, is unlovable. And here's the physics thing that goes with it, whether you are sick of hearing this or not. It's absolutely at the under, it underscores every relationship, the law of attraction. If I don't really like who I am, if I don't even know who I am, but if I don't like who I suspect I am, ultimately I'm going to try to hide it, cover it up with everything, cosmetic surgery, lies, stories, money, cars, all this stuff, like you said, until you eventually discover it, which you will, because that's what happens. The soul, the spirit, we crave more intimacy, and over time, like Aristotle said, you know, we want to merge with the divine. We want to become one. Anything that's fake or in the way of that is going to rise its ugly head. Like they say, love brings up everything unlike itself. So whatever's inauthentic, ultimately, it's going to see the light of day. And boy, you know, it's just not worth it to keep playing this little game. We need to wake up. That's what I say.
Well, let's take it a step further. You and I meet, and you attract me, and I'm the kind of guy that bruises women, okay? I'm not, but I'm the kind of guy who bruises women, and you can't understand why you're in this relationship, and you dump me, and you go find somebody else, and somebody else is a bruiser also. Because deep down, you're going to choose the people who you can prove yourself right about yourself with, and that's what's going to happen.
Well, you know, I wish that were as simple as that, because typically when you meet a bruiser and it's more than a one-shot deal, in other words, your pattern is to continually attract bruisers and you're scratching your head thinking, oh my God, how does this keep happening? Well, 9 times out of 10, there are exceptions like that one person, but 9 times out of 10, it's because their treatment of you on some level really matches fundamentally what you believe about love. That's the hard part. This is the work most of us don't want to do. We really don't, hence the name responsible, we don't want to be responsible for what our beliefs are, for how we feel about ourselves, for investigating the origin of our belief and love maps inside of ourselves. We don't want to do the work. We want the junk. We want what's in the movies, right? We want to go pounding down the beach in slow motion, and I see you, and you see me, and Oh, my God, that feeling, you know what I'm talking about, that feeling that sends you like nothing else does to a place that nothing else can, and we see it, and we think it's true, and we just keep desperately trying to find this because we believe it's possible. This is really the great...
What stops it, Marianne, what stops it is we quit smoking that stuff.
What's that?
I said, what stops it is we quit smoking that stuff. See, what you said before, I know, it's coming from the unconscious. That's what you said. I don't even think the unconscious knows what love is. What the unconscious knows is what pattern is. And if you've had a pattern, what's going to happen, it's unconsciously going to tap into, you see somebody, and what will happen, it'll unconsciously tap into an experience that you had and create an emotion that's tied to it. And what you're dealing with is not that person you see right now, but somebody who beat you up before, or somebody who loved you before. Attraction is nothing more than a shot of dopamine.
That's exactly right. It's well said. And until we start to really see our patterns and the design of our unconscious and the persona we've created, until we take care and really learn, which is self-love, really, the epitome of self-love is taking care to investigate all the origins of these things. Then when we understand that, then we can, I believe, we have an exponentially better chance of not only attracting a really great partner, but then we've got some skills and some tools, a means to navigate into deeper terrain, into greater intimacy. But again, the big divide is for so many of us, we just don't have that work ethic. We have the junkie mentality. We go for the chemistry. And honestly, time and again, we just have to say it, until we're really willing to do the work, we're just going to have these very short-term, very intense, maybe passionate relationships. Now, right about here is when people say, oh, my God, I'm going to be bored, right? I'm going to have a vanilla relationship that's really healthy. What are you telling me? Chemistry is nothing? I hear this all the time, and I say, it's not nothing. It just needs a different perspective. It needs a different place in your priorities. If it's the number one priority, well, then you get what you get. You get a really hot relationship that's probably very unconscious. If we have other, you know, it's like having a one-horse, one-buggy show, right? How far are you going to get? If you're going for the long haul, you probably want a team of stallions or maybe a whole pack. You want to stack the deck in your favor, like we say with the certification of responsible relationship. You want to set yourself up to succeed, the definition of which is having these tools, this insight, really honing your radar, your intuition, that internal mechanism that helps you, once you have your tools, to, on the other side of this, all this work, the fun part, where you interview people, I-N-N-E-R. You interview people, you take into consideration the chemistry, and you ask the hard questions, and you wait and see if what people say and what they do matches over time, because trust and respect are critical to a healthy, fulfilling, and sexy hot relationship, by the way. Critical to hold the relationship together.
One question can fix most of that. One simple question up front that nobody asks. You ready for this question?
I am.
How do you receive love? Nobody ever asks anybody that. Imagine what would happen. You and I meet, okay? Don't tell him we're secret again. When you and I meet, and we get into this great relationship. And let's say all of my life, the way I've received love was a wink, a look, a tone of voice, expression. That's how I received it. That's how I give it. For you, on the other hand, maybe if you buy you something, that means I love you. We go on for two years. I'm winking, I'm looking, I'm touching, I'm doing everything I can to show you how much I love you. 2 years later, I walk in, and you've got everything packed.
Right.
I said, what's wrong? He said, I'm leaving.
I'm
going to
interrupt this little fantasy you've got. And
never show
I'm
me.
I'm going to offer a suggestion that love is a verb. You know, we are a culture obsessed with nouns and things. Love is not a thing to earn or to give or bestow, even, in my humble opinion and over my lifetime of observing relationship dynamics. love is a field of energy. It's a state of mind. It's a way of behaving on a regular basis. It's not anything. And this is how I would answer your question. It's a priority to be in this field. And really a wonderful question worthy of investigating, because if you do think it's a thing, that might be part of the problem.
But wait, right? But let me hold you up. Let's go after this one. Whatever love is, you know, obviously, you know, it's a vibration, it's a this, it's a that, it's a feeling, whatever. But if you don't know how the other person has learned to receive it, you're going to have a problem, at least if they tell you how they've learned to receive it.
What I'm hearing you say,
you've got a common ground to work with.
Yeah, you need to share a similar reality, which is different than giving anything. I think we're saying the same thing here. What I think we're saying is that one needs to share the same idea of love for it to flow and be understood between each other. You need to understand what love means for me, what it looks like for me. And if it means things and a way of behaving, if what I'm hearing you say is correct, then I need my partner to know that. And not only know it, I need to be convinced that they understand, because it's so important for me, whether it's a feeling, a vibe, a thing, whatever.
Yeah.
So does that make sense? I feel like now we're talking
about
the
same thing. That was just a hypothetical for the example. But the point of contention is, if you don't ask, you're not going to know. Men are, quote-unquote, expected to know. How many men know how to kiss you? None. You have to tell them. But the point is we never ask anybody.
Yeah.
So very interesting. All you got to do is ask. And what a difference it can make.
And we need to stop being so afraid to have these conversations. We need some more role models, some more folks that are willing, like yourself, some more men who are willing to come out and say, hey, I don't know, but boy, do I want to know. I really want the good stuff. And not knowing isn't a bad place to start, but let's don't pretend we know when we don't know, or let's don't resent something unless we're willing to speak up about it. You make a great point here. So I just want to take my hat off to you and any man who's willing to stay in the ring and go, look, we can make this work together. We just need to ask, as you said, some of the right questions. And there's a lot of information out there now, a lot of tools available.
Marianne, it took me 100 years to find out.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know what?
Yeah, but
better
I'm looking good
ever,
for 100.
Right?
Okay.
Well,
okay,
I'm
now,
glad
by the way,
you did.
We're starting to run out of time. Now, let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Oh, you bet. MaryanneLive.com, MaryanneLive, LIVE.com. We'd be so delighted if you would visit us there. We've got a lot to offer.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. Blessings to you and everybody else.
Good night.
Good night.
I promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Every night I hope and pray
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. She's back, Nina Amir. She's an author. She's a book editor. She's the author of How to Get Your Book Written with an... Oh, no, that's not an author. That's a topic. Hey, Nina, I should stop taking the drugs or start taking them. How are you?
There's a book.
I didn't tell you that you were going to be part of a book doing blogging, did I?
I am a author of a book about blogging.
Yeah, but you're going to be another one. I forgot to tell you.
I am?
Yeah, I decided to do a whole chapter in my book about blogging.
I
don't know what I'm doing, so I'm going to get you to write it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now, by the way. I'm very serious about that. But how to get your book written with an accountability partner. What is an accountability partner?
Well, an accountability partner is someone who holds you accountable to make sure you do what you say you're going to do.
Somebody to drive you nuts.
Yeah, someone to drive you nuts.
So, you know what? Brilliant idea.
Yeah, so if you're having trouble getting your book written, you know, you're not finding time, you're feeling blocked, you're stumped, you can't get yourself to put your tuchus in the chair and write the darn book, you find someone who you can report to on a regular basis on your progress.
You get excited about this title and you call somebody up and say, look what I got. And she says, no.
That's not an accountability partner, but yeah, that would be me.
Yeah, and I know somebody who called you and you went, no.
That's right. Okay. That would be me, but that's not an accountability partner. An accountability partner could be your... it could be a writing friend, you know, somebody you know who also writes, who you becomes your cohort in this, or it could be, it could just be a friend, and it could be a writing coach, but it's someone that you're going to get together with on a weekly basis or a biweekly basis or once a month, who's going to keep you on task, basically.
Okay, so realistically, what we're dealing with is somebody who is going to mother you to make sure that you get up at the right time, that you do this at the right time, to make sure that you're focused, and when you're supposed to have it done, it gets done.
Not necessarily that you do it at the right time, but that you just do it. So it could be that it's at the... Well, let me take that back. It could be that it's at the right time, that you pick a time. Because, for instance, if you wanted to hook up with a friend, let's say, or a writing friend or just a friend... it could be that you pick a time. So, for instance, I have done this twice with friends. Once it was with a friend of mine. We were just a town away, and we both were writers, and we decided that we would call each other up and say, okay, we're sitting down, and we said, this is what I'm writing, and she said, this is what I'm writing, and we wrote for an hour. And then we called each other up afterwards, and we said... We basically checked in on how it went. We even emailed each other what we wrote and critiqued it for each other. That was one way I've done it. Another way I did it was with a friend of mine. I live in California. She lives in Atlanta. We weren't getting our writing done. We said, let's be accountability partners. And we would, via Skype, not the video Skype, just the texting type Skype, you know, we would email each other on Skype and just say, I'm here. We had a time. Of course, her time was different than mine. It was 9 a.m. where I was, and it was 12 where she was, so it was noon. And we would just text and say, I'm here at the computer, and I'm ready to go. You know, ready, set, go, write. And we would write for a couple hours. And even if she wasn't there, so let's say she decided she had a meeting and she skipped out, there was this accountability, this feeling that I was supposed to be there. We agreed. So if she skipped out, well, she skipped out. But I said I was going to be there, and I was there. And I actually wrote a ton for several months because I was supposed to be in my seat at the computer writing at that time. And sometimes she would come in late. She wasn't as good about it. And she would show up, you know, an hour later or something. But we both knew we were supposed to be there, and both of us actually got a lot of writing done in that time just because somebody knew we were supposed to be there writing.
You know, that makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of people just need that backup of somebody to say, it's time, or let's sit down and do it. There's that word called procrastination, the big P word, and that P word, it affects a lot of people. You know, you want to do it, and then there's going to be 15,000 things that are going to cause you not to do it. And I really believe when it comes down to it, which you're talking about, absolutely brilliant.
Well, and it's that having someone there to say, you know, did you do it? Did you do it? And you have to say, yes, I did it, or no, I didn't. And when you have to say, no, I didn't, the theory is that that doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
And even if it's just within yourself, you know, that should be enough to make you want to go do what you said you were going to do. And if it's not, then at least there's someone there saying, you need to go sit down and do it. You said you were going to do it. You didn't meet your goal. You didn't do what you said you were going to do. So go sit down and do it.
Yeah. No, I think that makes all the sense in the world, because when you really come down to it, you get, being Jewish, I know this word, I'm going to give you the G word, guilty.
Yes, and if you don't, right.
Yes, yes. And the guilt starts, and then you're in major trouble.
That's that mothering thing you said earlier.
Yeah. But I think I really think that most people need, and I don't even if it's not writing, it's that somebody. Now, what's the difference between buddying up with somebody or getting a professional coach?
Okay, so for instance, I'm a coach, and if I work with my clients, they're actually paying me, of course. So that's one big difference. And yeah, we then set up a schedule, and they check in with me weekly about their progress on their books, and we're going to have a format for that, and we check in, we discuss what they've accomplished since the last session. I will have probably given them tasks. So it's not just that they say to me, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell them this is also what you need to do in order to meet their goals. They may have deadlines. We're going to discuss what they still need to accomplish, what they want to get done in the next week. And we're going to brainstorm ideas, and I may help them get unstuck if they're having trouble, and I may also read some of their copy for them to make sure they're on track. And now, having a coach, for some people, the fact that they're actually spending money on a coach can keep them working, and it's sad but true. I have a client who doesn't have a lot of money, but she's paying me because she needs to get her book done by the end of October, and she was not getting it written. And she can't afford not to get it done, and she can't afford to lose the money that she's paid me. So she's working really hard. And sometimes paying money to a coach is a really good incentive, a bigger one than just wanting to write the book. Now, for other people, just reporting in to someone is really all it takes for them. And I can tell you that for me, the reporting in, I mean, well, if I was paying a coach, that would be a good incentive. But reporting in is usually enough for me. I had a group that I belonged to, a bunch of different writers, and we were doing a lot of actually promotional stuff as well as writing. And we met every month, and I would tell them what I plan to accomplish over the course of the next 30 days. And, you know, half the time I was rushing to get it done before the next meeting, like that week or the few days before the meeting. But I almost always had those tasks done, including all the other stuff I'd done in the 3 weeks before, you know, right after the meeting. But those things that I said I was going to get done, I almost always got them done, because for me, that was enough. But for a lot of people, they need a coach. They need someone that's, you know, that they're paying. And I don't know why that is, but it seems that added money seems to really work.
Incentive, incentive, incentive. Okay, so let's say, for instance, I decide I want to do something like this, but I don't want to go to a professional. I want to find an accountability partner. What kind of person do I look for? What are some of the things that I could say, okay, I want this, and I want that?
Well, for an accountability partner, what you want is someone that you can rely on that's going to be there with you, that, you know, isn't going to back out. So they need to be reliable. And it's best if it's another writer, if you can have it be someone who understands the kind of work you're doing, but it does not have to be. It's good if there's someone who is going to be maybe not business oriented, but detail oriented, because you want to do the following. You want to keep a record of what you said you would do from one meeting to the next. So if you say, I'm going to write two chapters, you want them to have a record of that as well as you. And you want to report in on what you've accomplished. So you want them to be asking you to do that. So it needs to be someone willing to do that. And you want it to be someone who isn't afraid of you, like to lose your friendship, so because they need to say to you, why haven't you met your goals? You know, why didn't you do it? Because you need to be accountable also, you know,
so
for
you mean
your
actions. If I yell at that person, I'm not yelling at them, I'm yelling at the accountability partner.
Right. So it has to become somewhat impersonal.
Yeah.
And you have to set new goals each meeting. So, you know, there has to be a structure to this, and they have to be willing to do that. And they also have to listen to you talk through your problems and offer feedback to not just be a sounding board, because that's what a coach does for you. So that's the thing that's a little lacking in just having it be a friend as opposed to a coach. So if you're picking a friend or a person, it's best if you can find someone who has a little bit of coaching skills, like life coaching skills.
Yeah.
For that reason,
that
you want someone who, you know, might be able to offer you that kind of sounding board and, you know, giving you a way to help you when you're stuck.
All right. So in essence, what we're really looking for is somebody who's going to be neutral, somebody who is going to give it back to you the way that you need to hear it, and not necessarily worry about sensitivities. Just get in there, get it done, and make sure that when you say you're going to do something, you do it.
Right. So my friend Karen was great. My friend Karen has been my best friend for years and years and years, but she's also a life coach. So if I'm procrastinating and I'm giving her a lot of stories about why I'm not getting it done, she's going to tell me. She's going to say, Nina, you're full of you-know-what. Just sit down and write and stop giving me the stories. You're just making up a whole lot of excuses for why you're not getting it done.
Truly makes sense to me. All right, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. One more question. How do I find, and I wouldn't go up to anybody but you, but how do I find a coach if I'm not me and if I'm somebody out there and I really want to get a coach? What do I look for?
You want to find, you know, if possible, obviously someone with credentials and experience. If you don't know someone with credentials and experience, you can ask people who they've used for a book coach. But let's say you don't know someone in the writing, you know, who also is a writer. You could Google writing coaches and then interview them. You could go to LinkedIn, which is a great resource, and go to the books and writers groups. And then you could ask people in there who they've used. That's a great resource. People are really happy to recommend their favorite book coach. Of course, like you said, I'm a book coach. You can check me out. You want to click with the person, though. They should inspire you and fit your style. You know, I'm really matter-of-fact. Tell it like it is. I don't beat around the bush. Maybe you want to coach the sugarcoats things. I probably am not for you. You want a coach that gives you possibly a little time up front, even 15 minutes of free coaching so you can, you know, see if you like them. And you want someone familiar with your genre that's worked with enough writers and achieved some success with those writers. Those are the kind of things that I would recommend when you're out there looking, you know, and ask for their success record and possibly for some testimonials.
Now, love every second of it. Nina, website we can find you at?
The place to go for all my writing work is Copyright Communications, spelled Copywright Communications.com. And if that's too hard, just go to ninaamir.com, ninaamir.com, and you can find links to all my websites there.
Wonderful. Nina Amir, see you next week.
Thanks so much. See you then.
Good night.
Bye.
This poor little child was only 9 years of age when mother and dad went away. So she bravely worked at the one thing she knew to earn her few pennies a day. She made artificial flowers
artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of fashion to wear. She made artificial flowers, you know those artificial flowers, fashion from Annie's despair. With paper and shears, with some wire and wax, she made up each tulip and mum. Snowflakes drifted into her tenement room, her baby little fingers numb. From making artificial flowers, artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of high fashion to wear, she made artificial flowers, artificial flowers, made from Annie's despair. They found little Annie all covered with ice, still clutching her poor frozen shears. Amidst all the blossoms she had fashioned by hand and watered with all her young tears.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
In heavenly gardens and bowers, and instead of a halo, she'll wear around her head a garland of genuine flowers. No more artificial flowers. Throw away those artificial flowers.
As Monday Helowati is with us, he is an author, he's an inventor, an engineer, a motivational speaker, a co-active success coach, and a volunteer firefighter. He spent over $100,000 on some of the best seminars and training in the world. And he's learned that what makes people successful today is something called mindset. And let us say, Asmundi, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much again for the opportunity to be on the show. Very grateful.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Okay, let's talk about your book. And it's going to be a series now. And the book is Unleash the Billionaire Within. Asmundi, are we hearing here that you're saying that being a billionaire, being wealthy, is a mindset?
It is definitely a mindset. And it's coming from a mindset of abundance. I actually just finished writing an article last night for my friend's newsletter, Buzz Magazine, on abundance. And the mindset of a billionaire is definitely abundance. And for the most part, that's not something that happened overnight for a lot of the people that became billionaires, like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett. Those people definitely worked very diligently and hard to earn their money over the years. And not only did they earn their money, they had the infrastructure to handle the growth of their companies as they rapidly grew so fast.
Okay, so what we're really saying is, and stop me if I'm wrong, but what you're talking about, the mindset is a strategy. And the strategy is a process like anything else. Building a chair is a process. You start with the legs, you put the seat down, you put the back on. And becoming a billionaire, something to begin with, moving away from abundance for the most part, but being a billionaire is something you have to believe is a possibility. It's manageable. It's a goal that you can achieve. And one of the things that I have noticed for years and years and years, no matter what it is, you have to see it before it can actually happen. You have to get that image within your mind to be able to recognize what the billionaire is. If you can recognize it, then you can achieve it. If you don't know what it is, no matter what you do, you're not going to get there.
Yes, exactly. And like a lot of people view money as nothing, and it really isn't that much compared to, you know, a lot of the feelings people enjoy in life, being fulfilled, being grateful, you know, the wonderful senses that we have, which contribute so much to the enjoyment of life. But, I mean, there's a lot of things that do require money. You know, for example, people like yachting or fancy cars or fancy houses. These items require a lot of planning before they can be obtained. And not only do they require a lot of planning, they require a lot of strategy, sometimes taking decades to acquire. And, of course, you need to be able to protect yourself from professional takers along the way, too.
Sure. Now, I believe very strongly, Ismondi, that to be a billionaire, you first would have to define, and I'm not, but and I'm going to listen to what you say, because tomorrow I can be. But my contention is basically this, is that you have to define what a billionaire is. And once you make that definition for you, and you're right, it's not just money. What does being a billionaire mean? Is it freedom? Is it this? Is it that? Whatever the case may be. You're going to go out and you're going to be of service to people. Whatever that is, once you get that definition of what you want to be as a billionaire, then we move forward. So I don't think you're right. I think it's just the money. It's the symbology of what that word means.
Yes, and do you mind if I ask you what being a billionaire would mean to you?
Oh yeah, it would mean that my life wouldn't change a whole lot because I happen to love what I'm doing. But there would be a few extra things sitting down. There would be a few places that I would put the money. There'd be a couple of things that I would get, but it wouldn't change my life that much.
No, that's awesome, because it sounds like you're living already a fulfilled life that you really enjoy and you're passionate.
Yeah, there's challenges. About. There's obviously, like anything else, and there's a few things that I'm working towards. And when the time comes when you stop working towards something, it takes the fun out of it. You know, the journey isn't getting there. The journey getting there happens to be the journey in and of itself. But for the most part, life, it wouldn't change that drastically for me.
No, and that's so true. Like, I like what you're saying about the journey. Having studied coaching through the Coaches Training Institute, we've learned about the power of fulfillment coaching, which is where people basically take themselves on a journey going 20 years into the future, kind of imagining what they'd like to be, what values are dominant in their life, what beliefs are dominant in their life, so that they can kind of discover who they really are.
Sure. No, and by the way, there's another way to do that, and it was a simple, I've talked about it on the air before, but it's a very simple way to do that. You take yourself out 10, 20 years ahead, like you said, and then you put yourself at a party, and the party is in your honor, and you write down everything you would like people to say about you. Now, Ms. Mundy, you got 20 years to become it. You've got to have that picture.
Yeah.
But that's really what it comes down to, and I think that as far as, you know, what a billionaire means, I do think that has to be defined, because then that gives you the goal to go after. If it's just the money, it never ends. There's just one after another, and it never really stops. But if it's what that money can do for you, what that money means to you, you know, how you would apply it to yourself and the world around you.
Yes, exactly. And the power of philanthropy, too, you know, giving back to society. Some people have a lot of entrepreneurial gifts that maybe others don't. I mean, everybody has a talent, I believe, and I believe everyone's standing, you know, 3 feet from gold or even over their gold mine. But some people, it's easy for them to go make, you know, 100, 200, or $500 million.
Sure.
And what my book does is helps, whether it be somebody just starting out, but more importantly, or not, I shouldn't say more importantly, but those entrepreneurs with those gifts, it kind of ignites them and gets them moving forward so that they want to go after that next goal.
Yeah, but see, I really believe also that the, you know, when you talk about the billionaire mindset, the billionaire mindset, again, is not money. Let's take it a couple of in different areas.
Sure.
It's the increase in quality of the way you live, the increase in quality of how you present yourself to the world. So you can also be a billionaire based on your own emotional makeup, based on, like you said, what you give to the world. So a billionaire has got a lot of definition, and there's wealth. There's more wealth than just the dollar bill. There's emotional wealth. There's spiritual wealth. There's all kinds of wealth. So I would venture to guess there are billionaires out there in money, but they're lacking in the other areas to balance themselves out. Homeostasis, balance. And I really believe if you got the billionaire mindset, listening to what you're saying, that there is that balance. If you could become a billionaire, you're not only a billionaire with dollars, you're a billionaire with all the other phases and facets of your existence.
And I love what you're saying there, because you know, there's definitely a lot of passion in that, because it's so true. I mean, you see these people, they've got loads of money, loads of success, and then you see a picture of them and they're so unhappy, they're so unfulfilled, and you know, your heart goes out to them, but there goes the saying, money doesn't bring happiness.
No.
And that's where life coaching skills definitely come into every aspect of life, and every level of life for wherever people are financially.
Sure. And, you know, there's that old contention that people have, you know, do I want to be a billionaire? People can say that they do, but unconsciously they can stop themselves, because the pain for not getting what you want in some cases is more emotionally satisfying than getting what you want. So when somebody says, I want to be a billionaire, you better know exactly what it is that you're talking about, because you can lead yourself also on a life of absolute depression and frustration and failure. Because if that unconscious, and you said mindset, if that unconscious area of your mind says that you don't deserve it, well, you're going to end up in failure constantly. So there's got to be that shift in thinking and that shift in the emotional stability that causes you to do and be what you are.
Yeah, and I believe that has a lot to do with self-confidence. Like sometimes, like you say, some people, they might just not feel they're deserving of wealth, or because of their blueprint for life so far. But really, when we analyze new blueprints, we can kind of incorporate that into our life and realize, you know, we are worthy of so much abundance in life.
Interesting word when you said blueprint. The brain is a blueprint.
Yeah.
And if you structure it in the right way, you get the results that you structured it. The brain is very much like a computer, information in, information out. And based on how you structure the pattern that you're dealing with now, it doesn't matter what you did in the past. Restructure. The brain is restructurable, and everything in your life can turn around.
Exactly, and that's what I love about life coaching. Like having gone to many Anthony Robbins seminars, I always love the environment there, because it's such an environment of self-discovery, and you know, each individual can discover how really anything is possible in life if you model the right people and you learn the right skills. And I always love that, because it allows someone to step out of the box and design that purpose statement, that mission statement for life. I mean, not forgetting the now. I mean, we need to always realize where we are in the now, so we're not chasing a mirage, so to speak. But it does give a lot of purpose and movement to life.
Now, I know, by the way, purpose is extremely important, because the people do have purpose. Purpose to beat yourself up, purpose to not get this, purpose to not get that. And all there is just that simple shift in thinking, which causes the purpose to change. And once the purpose changed, things come the way you want them to come. I mean, it sounds as though it's too simple, but all it is just a shift in the way you think about things and the end result.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I mean, you think about if each person or an individual can invent something, market into a store that has, say, 4,000 chain stores, and sell 1,000 products a year, that at a $25 profit, that person is now making, you know, $100 million a year.
Sure.
And now has more money to reinvest in other business ventures.
You know,
so if that person is fulfilled...
You were talking about philanthropy before. You know, I was thinking about that as you're talking. My mind is going here. And one of the ways that I would love to be a philanthropist is not dump tons of money into organizations and whatever, but what I'd love to do is I would love to find families, a particular family, and bring them to the place where they had a decent life, bring them to the place where their kids could get a good education. And I really believe that if you do it, you know, with a wide swath, that you dilute the effort and the energy that you're out there, because there's always going to be somebody in between that's going to get a percentage of it. But if you found individuals, and if you found enough individuals, and, you know, it's called pay it forward, obviously. But I think that in and of itself would set its own mindset for those people who did get help to help somebody else who would eventually already be helped, that they can help somebody.
Yeah, and it would create kind of that chain reaction of people really authentically feeling grateful for somebody helping them out in life where they really needed help.
Yeah, no question about it. All right, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website that we can find you at?
Yes. at www.bec-inc.com. And I also have a mega launch going on for my book right now, where I'm giving many free promotions from, like, a free ebook from Jack Canfield, Mark Victor Hansen, and Matt Can Do, Christy Whitman, and more. And that's on the Dresser After Dark site. So just click on my LinkedIn site there, and it'll take you right to it.
Wonderful. Ismondi, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you so much, Michael. Rick.
Take care.
Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. John Gilbert Simmons with us, the co-author of TPA for Stroke, The Story of a Controversial Drug. He writes about science and medicine for both general and professional audiences. In his two acclaimed books, he's charted the history of science and medicine. His The Science of Scientific 100 profiled 100 of the most influential scientists in history and has been translated over a dozen times and published worldwide. Most recently, he's authored Doctor and Discoveries, Lives That Created Today's Medicine. He's also published four novels and written for film and television, a graduate of Northern University and Long Island University, a member of the Authors Guild, the National Association of Science Writers, the New York Academy of Sciences, the Writers Guild of America, and the Writers Guild of Canada. And let us say, John, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be with
you. And in your spare time, you do what? John, when we come down to this, you know, with all of your background, when we talk about TPA for stroke, what is it that we're dealing with? What was it that caused you to take a look at this and put this to pen?
Well, I had a number of motives. One of them was personal. My father had died of a stroke, and I recall it well. And strokes since he died in 1981, there was developed a medicine to treat just the kind of stroke that he had, which is about almost 90%, almost 9 in 10 strokes are called ischemic. They're due to blood clots that cause blockages in the blood vasculature that surrounds the brain. And it's a simple question of plumbing, if you want to put it, you know, simply. And in fact, the drug TPA that has been developed to be used in to treat acute stroke is sometimes likened to Drano, you know, the stuff for clearing pipes.
Sure, but isn't what we're dealing with also a blockage of the blood system in the brain?
That's it. That is what we're dealing with. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Blood clots form and cause blockages, and TPA can be used to dissolve those blood clots. That's exactly
now, by
right.
the way, the drug in and of itself, is this a new drug? Is this something that just hit the market, or has this drug been out for a while?
No, it has an interesting history, which is one of the other things that attracted to me about writing about the discovery of an important and controversial drug. TPA was originally developed for heart attack, the same thing that causes stroke also causes heart attack, blood clots. And my co-author, Justin Zivin, the book would not have been written without him. He was the one who initiated it. Did the first experiments in 1985 that showed that this substance, TPA, could be used to dissolve the clots that cause stroke. And TPA went on to be approved by the FDA to treat stroke in 1996. The problem has been that there is a time window to get the drug when you have the symptoms. You have to get to the hospital right away. You have to know about the drug. You have to know about the drug. You have to know that stroke symptoms are sudden and sometimes painless. And you have to act right away. And if you get the drug, TPA, you can be saved. It's not so much a question of saving you from death, because just like with heart attack, a lot of people die from stroke. But stroke is also the leading cause of adult disability. And you can have a stroke, and you will be unable to talk, unable to walk, unable to carry on the activities of daily life. That's the real danger of stroke, and that's the real value of TPA.
Sure, and what I can see, and I'm not a clinician, by the way, and I haven't, I've done a tremendous amount of interviews, but I haven't heard of TPA before. But when you come down to it, what we're talking about, it would be a blood clot in the brain. And that blood clot's going to cause a disconnect, and everything that's supposed to work in the brain is not going to work anymore, because that clot is stopping everything from doing what it's supposed to do. So it seems as though, yeah, if they get to the hospital, as you're saying it, if that happens to someone, it knocks the clot out real quick, and it allows the brain to function and everything to move the way it's supposed to move before anything can happen and there's any ill side effect.
That's right. That's exactly right. And the problem is that time window, which is wider than it was when the drug was first approved, it was 3 hours then. It's now open to about 4.5 hours, but faster is better. The quicker you get to the, the quicker you call 911 is what people are urged to do, and get to the hospital right away, the better chance you have of dissolving the clot before the clot can cause problems in the brain itself.
Okay, so if we're dealing with this, why isn't it that the drug hasn't been publicized before? Why haven't we heard about this drug?
It's a very good question, and we spend the book TPA for Stroke. We didn't like the title of the book. It sounds kind of technical, but the publisher, Oxford University Press, wanted it. It's really a book that can be read by anyone. It's really it's narrative based, and it's the story of this drug. But when the drug came out, strokes, generally speaking, when people had strokes, they would maybe go to the hospital eventually, and nothing really could be done for them. And this was something that persisted, over the course of decades. Best part of 150 years, really. Nothing could be done. And then when this drug was tested and shown to work, it was approved by the FDA, and there were high hopes that the drug would be used a lot. And in fact, it's only been used very little, and in part for because people just don't know, first of all, the symptoms of a stroke, and second of all, they don't know that the drug exists. There was an additional problem, which was that neurologists, when the drug was approved, were not used to treating emergencies in medicine. They were used to treating slow diseases. Parkinson's disease is a slow disease, for example. And so they really weren't kind of educated or didn't want to get up in the middle of the night and rush to the hospital and give a CAT scan to somebody to see if they're having a bleeding stroke rather than an ischemic stroke. And that left the emergency physicians, the emergency doctors, holding the bag, so to speak, and they didn't like that. So there's been resistance to the drug based on a kind of a series of rationalizations. Now, because over the course of 15 years, every study that's been done has shown that the drug works as advertised. If you have symptoms of stroke and get to the hospital and get the drug, your chances of avoiding disability or even actually now death, but disability especially, are much, much greater.
I think one of the problems that we're dealing with is that you talk about symptoms, but we are also in a place that, John, there are times when there are no symptoms. It hits and you don't know it's coming. And if you're not around anybody and you can't get to a phone, it could be too late for so many people. So stroke in and of itself are one of those things. Yeah, there's going to be symptoms. One of the things that I learned to do years ago is ask somebody to say their name, to talk. If they're coherent, they're okay.
Very good, yes.
Coherent, yeah, get them to the hospital fast.
I should say that there are about almost 800,000 new strokes every year in the U.S. That's a lot of strokes. It makes stroke a big disease. And we know that not everybody is going to be eligible for the drug. And we know that there are a certain number of strokes that are going to be massive, and we expect that just like with heart attack. But it would be if people, although strokes don't typically involve pain, there is a, kind of a mnemonic device called FAST, for example, which allows you to kind of ask questions to see if you're having a stroke. It's simply, can you smile? Does one side of your face droop? And can you raise both arms? Does one arm kind of drift downward? Can you say a simple sentence without your speech being slurred or strange? And if you see any of these signs, then it's just time to call 911 and get to the hospital right away. And most hospitals are equipped to give TPA.
Is that a prescription drug? I mean, directly from the doctor.
Yeah, well, let me explain. Right, yes, exactly. Yeah, not only is TPA a prescription drug, but you need to get to the hospital right away so that you can receive a CAT scan, a scan of your brain, and that scan will show whether you're having a bleeding stroke, in which case you could not get TPA. So it's kind of an exclusionary criteria. And there are some other criteria that need to be applied before you can get the drug. But the drug itself is not difficult to administer. It's simply an injection. So once it's decided you can get TPA, there's not a problem in actually giving it.
Okay, so now let me ask you this, that it's the TPA. So if everybody knows that this is available and there is a problem, quote unquote, that if you don't get it within a certain period of time, it's not going to have the effect that that it can have on you. How do you get that message out to so many people that they truly get it and get the book and understand that what we're dealing here is something that could save your life?
That's exactly the problem we're trying to wrestle with. And there has been some advance over the years where initially just about almost 2 to 3% of stroke victims received TPA, whereas we anticipated that as many as half or 50% could receive TPA. Now that figure has doubled to about 5%. There are places you might live in the United States where, because of the prominence of the medical centers there and their interest in stroke, you are more likely to receive TPA and more likely perhaps to know about it. In Houston, for example, in San Diego, where Justin Zivin, my co-author, is located, there are hospitals, you know, in the U.S. where they pay special attention to stroke, and there are also a lot of stroke centers that have opened in the past 10 to 15 years that all will provide TPA if you get to the emergency room in time.
Okay, so in essence, there I think the important message here that there is help. There is the possibility of saving your life if, A, you know what to ask for. Now, I guess this begs the other question. The other question is this, that if I go to the hospital, if I'm having a stroke, and if I don't know what to ask for, if I don't know what to say, do you have TPA, can I get it, do they know what to give you?
Yes, they do know what to give you. But it has also been our experience that if people have enough, just a little bit of knowledge, enough knowledge to know what the stroke symptoms are, and also to know about TPA, that they, you know, have a much better chance of getting to the hospital and receiving it. There's been in the past resistance on the part of some emergency physicians to provide TPA. It would be a fair conjecture that if you go to the hospital and bring up the issue, that you're much more likely to get it. If you meet the criteria, that is, if you're not having a bleeding stroke and there are a few other things.
Sure. Sure. Now, by the way, the TPA has been out for a while. You said something interesting early on. You said it was good for 3 hours. Now it's up to 4 hours. Is that the strength of the TPA, or do they keep upgrading the drug?
No, the time window, which is what it's called, was based on randomized control trials. Nobody knows what the, you know, ideal window is or the extreme window is for any one patient. So it's a statistical, you know, measure. Over the past 15 years, they've done a number of studies of different kinds that show, most recently two studies from Europe called ECAS, that show that they can get just as good results or good results, up to 4.5 hours. But it's not like you can go in 5 hours later and expect to get the drug. They won't give it to you. It's you're not going to get it because it's too late. In most cases, I shouldn't say not in all cases, but in most cases, that's too late. So the time window needs to be respected. But it's not due to anything inherent in the drug, and it's not due to any real new knowledge about the drug. It's a kind of a best-guess scenario.
Okay. Now, by the way, the information is absolutely phenomenal. Now, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, John?
Well, there's my website, but I can also recommend that people can find the book on Facebook at the book TPA for Stroke. And it will lead you to a variety of portals, including the Amazon site and the Oxford University Press site. And the book is explained in some detail at Oxford University Press. If you Google TPA for stroke Oxford or OUP, you'll reach it very quickly.
Okay, T is in Tom, P is in Paul, A is in Alan. TPA for Stroke, the story of a controversial drug. Hey, John, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. Go get them. I think it's a great job you're doing.
Thank you, Michael. It's been great talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
How's you know, honey? You always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only. Cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
whatever you've done, it's all over. Whatever you've been is so strange. Yesterday's long gone forever. Damned if what you're feeling isn't change. Music that used to seem hollow now seems to fit in your range. Today is the now and the never. Damned if what you're feeling isn't change. It's fun to wander along a yesterday road, trying so hard to retain all of the wondrous and beautiful times that never can happen again.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Boyd Purcell with us, Dr. Boyd Purcell, Ph.D. He's the author of Spiritual Terrorism, Spiritual Abuse from the Womb to the Tomb. He's a National Board Certified Counselor, a licensed professional counselor, an ordained Christian minister, and a board certified chaplain. Educationally, he's a Bachelor of Science degree in Comprehensive Social Studies, Geography, Political Science. He's also has a Master of Arts degree in Counseling and a Master of Divinity degree in Biblical Studies and a Doctor of Philosophy degree and the integration of philosophy and theology. And let us say, Boyd, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Spiritual terrorism, spiritual abuse from the womb to the tomb. There are many people that are controlled by spiritualism, aren't there?
Well, they're controlled by fear. And
okay, yes.
There's a lot of fear in religion, but I contrast the difference between love-based religion and fear-based religion. The fear-based religion can really be very controlling, very detrimental to the person, and cause many mental, emotional health problems.
Okay, now, but how do you distinguish between the two? And I think it's a fair question. There's so many people out there, and I've heard it time and again over the years, someone will say, you know, God hates the homosexual. If you do this, God's going to get you, which is fear-based. And how do you distinguish that between the love base? And I've sat back and I've listened to that for years, and there's got to be a way that people can truly get what God is about, and from not the fear of what's going to happen if they don't believe, but the love of wanting to believe because of what's there.
Well, I agree 100% with what you're saying. And when we say God loves you, which almost all religions do, almost all Christians say that, probably 100% say that. But what they typically say, God loves you, but. Now, in counseling, I learned that when you say make a statement with a but, the but negates what comes before. So when God loves you with unconditional, everlasting love, that's a period or an exclamation point. It should be not a but after that. When they do, then that you have to do all these things, X, Y, and Z, or umpteen things, to obtain God's favor, merit his love, and be able to go to heaven. All the things you have to do, all the things you can't do, or the same God who loves you with unconditional, everlasting love is going to condemn you and cast you into eternal, literal hellfire when you will be tortured forever. Now, infinite mercy, which is, God is infinitely merciful as well as loving, and eternal torture is an oxymoron. Those are inherent contradictions.
Somebody once said it when I was doing a show on it was spirituality and God, and the guest was saying, and this was within the last year, the guest was saying something to the effect of that, you know, if we're born with free will, why did God create war and why does God let people kill and why does God do this, this, and that? And I let it go till the end of the show, and then my comment basically was that you were born with free will. We have total free will. You want to stop the killing? Don't shoot anybody. You want to stop wars? Don't kill anybody. I mean, it's as simple as you have the free will not to do it. And I don't think God says, you know, go ahead and get this done, or we're going to do this to you or that to you. Free will is such a critical word, and there's such an abuse of it today in this world that we live in.
Well, you're right about that. And God, I believe, has given all human beings free will. But the very fact that God has given free will means that he will never violate that free will.
Yeah.
Therefore, people can do horrible things or they can do very loving things. You can have a Hitler or you can have a Mother Teresa. And people can't seem to chew gum and walk at the same time, so to speak, in that they can't seem to grasp this idea that God gave free will and God will never violate it, and yet God is so wise and so powerful that God's will eventually be done without violating anyone's free will, because it's the misuse of free will and all the pain and suffering that comes with that that will eventually bring the human race to learn to live in peace with each other so we can enjoy eternity with God and with one another with total peace throughout the universe.
Boy, this is what I've come to in my life as regards to God. And I really believe this in my heart of hearts. I don't believe God ever says no. I think you're born with a hand of cards, quote unquote, and you know, you're dealt a hand of cards, and how you play them is up to you. If you want poverty, God says yes. If you want wealth, God says yes. You want to be beat up, God says yes. I don't think God says no. The free will is what allows us to get into the messes that we get into, and sometimes we get out and sometimes we don't. I don't think no is in the spiritual vocabulary.
Well, again, I think you're right on. And I use an illustration in my book, The Spiritual Terrorism, The Spiritual Abuse in the Womb of the Tomb, in which President Eisenhower said that his mother was a very wise woman. And one time they were playing cards around the kitchen table, and he was complaining about the cards which he had gotten. And his mother finally said, "Boys, put your cards down," for him and his brothers. And she said that life is a lot like a game of cards. You don't know what hand you're going to get, but all you can do is play the hand you're dealt. And he learned from that, and he said that life is a lot like that.
I've told this story a couple of times on the air, but I guess it's time again. I was about 100 years ago, I was about 20-something years old, and I'm in the beach in Southern California. I'm laying there one night, and it is, I got to tell you, boy, it was one of the most gorgeous nights that I've ever seen. I'm laying there at night in the sand. I don't know what it was, 70, 75 degrees, very comfortable, and the sky was as clear as you could possibly get, and there was millions and millions and millions of stars out there. And I'm soaking it all in. It was just a wonderful night. There's some nice music going on. And then I started to think, big mistake. I started to think about, well, what's beyond that? And then I thought, well, how can there be anything beyond that? But it's got to stop. But then I thought, well, how can it stop? And with our linear thinking, I actually scared myself because I couldn't comprehend what was beyond the beyond. What that led me to was a philosophy. And I really, truly believe that it's, we don't know what the beyond is. You know, it's got to stop, but it can't stop. So really what we're dealing with is something that's undefinable. And my feeling is, and it has been for quite a while, and it's my feeling, that God is truly undefinable. How is a mind, how is a human mind going to wrap themselves around something that major? And if God's undefinable, and if somebody starts explaining what God's like, and, you know, God hates this, God hates that, hate, and those things are human emotions. And how can an all-powerful deity deal with human emotions, you know, be that part of it? So I really believe that it's something that's undefinable, and God's more of something that you know within, and you live that kind of a life, as opposed to a written description.
Well, I agree with that. God has created this whole universe, and maybe many universes besides this. I've been involved recently in noetic science, and that was started by Edgar Mitchell, who was an astronaut who landed on the moon. And on the way back, of course, he spent his whole life studying science, so he's very science-oriented. But he had this sort of epiphany that he's part of one big, living, interconnected universe. And he had no scientific data to back that up, but he felt just as sure of that as all the science which he had studied. And the noetic science says that there's not only this universe, but there is a parallel universe, and there are probably an infinite number of parallel universes like the one that we can see in which we live. So how big is God? Bigger and more grand and glorious than we probably ever begun to imagine, and we just can't begin to fathom this wonderful God and all of God's creation. It reminds me of what George MacDonald, a great theologian and thinker and prolific writer, said, who was the master of C.S. Lewis. He lamented the folly of those who had placed the boundary of their intellects around the infinity of God's redeeming love.
Yeah. And I think, and I'm going to talk extremism now. Extremism. If you look at the extremism in some of the Islamic sects, those that want to kill, not everybody, you got to qualify that, but those that want to kill, that you don't believe their way, you die. And that is spiritual terrorism. That's spiritual abuse.
So spiritual terrorism is actually the basis of domestic and international terrorism. Now, in Islam, you know, Christians tend to lump everyone together in Islam, in other religions, but there are a lot of variations in what Christians believe. We have a lot of different denominations. We have the four major divisions of Christianity with Catholicism, with the Anglican Church, the Church of England, with the Orthodox Church. That's 500 billion people in Eastern Europe, Russia and Eastern Europe. And then we have over 300 Protestant denominations. So Christianity is not just one monolithic church with everyone having the same belief. There are a lot of variations. Now, the same is true in Islam. There are about 2 billion Christians, but there are a billion Muslims in the world. So if they all hated us, we'd really be in a lot worse shape than we are right now.
Absolutely.
But there are probably less than 1%, one-tenth of 1% of Muslims who are involved in terrorism. Now, there are at least four divisions of Islam sects. There are actually more than that, but the four main ones would be the Sunnis. Almost all Arabs are Sunnis. The Iranians are Shiites, and they're of Persian descent. And the Arabs and the Persians have a long, a lot of antagonism over the centuries. And then there are the Sufi. Sufis are actually the universalists within Islam. And then there's a real conservative fundamentalistic sect called Wahhabism, or the Wahhabis. And that was Osama bin Laden's version of Islam. Very literal interpretation of the Holy Quran, very legalistic, and have a horrible view of God. God's very angry at sinners. God's going to get you, and we're going to help God get you. And that's where the terrorism comes from. But in Christianity, we have terrorists too, but we don't call them that. But Timothy McVeigh, who blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City, was a very conservative Catholic. And then we have Reverend Paul Hill, who's a Presbyterian, who assassinated an abortion doctor in Florida and was executed for it by the state of Florida. We have Eric Rudolph, who's a fundamentalist Christian, who bombed an abortion center in Atlanta, now serving life in prison because of that. So we have David Koresh in Texas, who the Waco thing that led so many people to their deaths
there.
So we do have Christian terrorists, we just don't call them that.
Yeah, no, I got it loud and clear. I I've seen it, I've heard it, and I've experienced it for so many years now. And it is, it's everything that God and religion shouldn't be. And when I say shouldn't be, it's taking the strength, the power of the deity, and controlling people. You do it my way or God's going to get you. Will you frighten somebody enough? Well, guess what? They're going to follow.
Well, many will. And some people are unstable and balanced, and they're going to try to please the leader and do some horrible things when they are given the suggestion or orders to do so.
Well, sure. And when you really look at it, there's no law against it. Think about that. Mm-hmm. There's no law against doing that.
Well, religious people get away with a lot that others might not because it's under the guise of religion. But I just saw on TV today that there was an organization that was calling itself a church that was busted by the government because they were using the church as a front for prostitution. Yeah. If you gave a donation to that, quote, church, unquote, then you could get sex from a prostitute. Now, that's a horrible thing to do in the name of religion.
Well, it's ridiculous, and it's been going on that way for many, many years, from every phase and every facet of religion. I happen to be Jewish, and I've seen it from all directions. It's going to happen. It's going to lead. It's going to control. And there are people who use the church, use the synagogue, use the mosque, and they use them to, I'm going to use the word again, control people, and the control is through fear, and there's your terrorism. And I'm sorry that there isn't a law against it.
Well, I know we have a religion in this country, and I'm all for freedom of religion.
Sure.
But people need to be circumspect in what they believe, what they accept as truth from religious leaders, because religious leaders may be sincere, but sincerely wrong, and some of them are probably just shysters who are out to make as much money and gain as much fame as they can.
No, I hear you loud and clear. We're just about out of time. Let me ask you something. Did you have any relatives that were Purcells in Alaska?
None of which I'm aware.
Okay. Yeah, I don't run into the name Purcell too often, and he's passed away now, but a very good friend of mine was a Lowell Purcell, and I knew him in Alaska for years and years and years and years. Okay.
I think the most Purcells that I'm related to would be in Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio area.
Okay. Yeah, Lowell was just one of those kind of guys that just didn't belong to the pack, quote unquote. Let me ask you this, Boyd, is there a website that we can find you at?
Yes, it's healingspiritualterrorism.com. A lot of free information there in addition to my book, Spiritual Terrorism, Spiritual Abuse from the Womb to the Tomb. By the way, the cover of my book is a picture of a blazing inferno. And the reason for that is that it depicts the problem of literal versus metaphorical interpretation of fire, not only in the Holy Bible or in the Torah, but in every major religion and all minor ones of which I'm aware. When fire is understood metaphorically to symbolize purification, then every major religion and all minor ones of which I'm aware teach universal salvation. The fundamentalists are literalist and legalist. They take the fire literally, and therefore they believe in eternal damnation.
I hear you loud and clear. Hey, Boyd, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your tears and laughter will linger after I had this to do again. And the evening were new again. I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.